So it's a pleasure to have Ruth Hanna from the University of Pennsylvania. Is that right? That's it. and she's going to cover things that have not been covered yet in the two previous talk on FDR techniques. It's an important technique, so it's great to have a talk on this subject. Thanks a lot, Ruth.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about some of my work on FDR and fMRI. And this is joint work with Yoav Benjamini from Tel Aviv University, as well as Nava Rubin, Damien Stanley, and Daniel Yucutieli on the first part, and Yulia Goland and Rafael Malach on the second part. So I'm going to really deal with three problems. The first one is to finding brain regions that respond to one cognitive task. I'm going to specifically concentrate on the question of whether to test clusters instead of voxels, and then how to control the false discovery rate on clusters. And then I'm going to talk about the more complicated setting of finding brain regions that respond to several cognitive tasks. And for that, I'm going to define tests of partial conjunction hypothesis as well as an appropriate error measure to control, which we call the overall FDR, or the OFDR for short. And finally, I'm going to talk about applying this method to group analysis, and this gives an alternative to fixed or random effect analysis that is typically done. Okay, so this is a flattened image of the brain, the two unfolded cortical hemispheres, showing in red the brain regions that reacted to the cognitive test. The goal of the researcher is to find these regions, and the question is how best to find them. So the common approach is voxel level analysis. Because every voxel is measured for activation, this is the most straightforward way to go about it. And now we have a problem of which of my 100,000 voxels are active. So if we do uncorrected testing, by which I mean that we test every single voxel at a 5% level, even if there is no brain activity, we would expect to detect 5,000 voxels as active. So clearly we have to control for false positives. Sorry. And we typically in fMRI, this is done in two ways. Either to control the probability of making at least one false positive, and this is controlling for the family-wise error using random field methods that Worsley introduced. Another option is to control the expected proportion of false positives out of all the rejections, and this is the false discovery rate, which was introduced by Benjamin and Hochberg. Now, I feel that this is a more relevant error rate when a large number of voxels are tested, if we can tolerate few false discoveries, as long as the proportion of false discoveries among discoveries is small. So basically, you have a map of your detections, and you know that 5% of them will be false. But this is a small percent. If you want to have more reliability, you can have 1% or 0.1%. But still, it's a proportion, and it's not controlling the fact that at least one. So you're really, there is no reason to control for just even one false positive, if it is, for example, at the periphery of a region. So the limitations of a voxel level analysis. Well, first of all, it does not exploit the signal spatial structure. Typically, it's not one voxel that is active, but it's a region, a set of contiguous voxels that are active together. So the common remedy is to smooth the data first. The problem with that is that it may reduce the signal-to-noise ratio of highly localized activity, and moreover, it introduces signal into non-active voxels. In addition, if we do voxel-level analysis, we need to control for an error measure on the voxels, but controlling for false positives at the voxel level may even not be relevant, no matter whether it's family-wise error or the FDR, because findings are really reported in terms of clusters of nearby voxels, and isolated voxel detectors are often even not reported as findings since they are deemed to be false findings. So what we suggest instead is to do a cluster level analysis. So to test clusters of contiguous voxels, the advantages are that the clusters approximate better the units of interest, which are really regions of activity, like in the image that I showed you at the beginning. We can have increased signal-to-noise ratio when pulling neighboring voxels together, so we have a better chance of detecting these clusters. And moreover, testing clusters reduces the multiple hypothesis problem because we go down from 100,000 tests at the voxel level to several hundred or several thousand tests at the cluster level. So the question is, first of all, of how to obtain these clusters. What we suggested was to approximate the cluster units from information outside the data to be tested, which is often available, such as a localizer experiment. On this localizer experiment, we can cluster nearby locations that are maximally correlated. So that's how we get those cluster units. And they are typically quite small, but more than one. They range, they're of size 5 or 10 voxels, say. If you don't have outside data, then there is a method that has been mentioned before, and this is to test contiguous voxels above an a priori fixed threshold. These are those voxels that are above this threshold are defining the clusters. This was introduced by Friston et al. And mentioned also in Nichols and Holmes. The problem here is that it's not clear how to choose this threshold above which we define clusters, but the choice significantly affects the results. So it has a large impact on the analysis. And moreover, the interpretation of discoveries from Chatham analysis are vague. It's not clear what a detected cluster really means. So we are going to assume that we have outside data, and that the clusters have been defined by outside data. I'm not going to go into how to define the clusters, but let's assume that this has been done and we have M clusters. And now what we want is for every cluster to test the null hypothesis that all the voxels in the clusters are non-active. So for one cluster, the following test statistic can be used. So you spatially average the measured signal within the cluster. Every voxel in the cluster has a time series. And now you get just one time series out, which is just the spatially average of the voxels that are within the time series. And for this spatially average time series, you would test it as if you would do it at the voxel level. So you can compute the test statistics of the spatially average time series from there in order to test the cluster null hypothesis. And now what you want is to control the false discovery rate, but on clusters instead of voxels. So you're basically controlling the expected proportion of falsely rejected cluster hypotheses out of all cluster hypotheses rejected. And this is the relevant error measure. Or alternatively, you can have an extension of that, which is the weighted FDR on clusters. For example, if you take the weights as the size of the cluster, let's say that it's more important for you to detect large clusters than to detect small clusters, then this error measure amounts to the expected proportion of area of false clusters out of all the area rejected. So this can be another relevant error measure. To see how these two differ, here's a toy example. So let's look here. We have half a slice, and then let's say that in blue are the true activations, which we typically don't know, but these are the true areas of activation in this slice, and then the result of a statistical analysis is encircled in red. So this is one discovery, this is another discovery, and this is a third discovery. So let's see what it means in terms of the error measures that we mentioned. So if we do, so the false discovery rate at the voxel level is 1 out of 5, 20%, because we have just one false discovery out of overall 5 voxel discoveries. However, the FDR at the cluster level is 33%, 1 out of 3, because this is a true cluster discovery. This is a true cluster discovery, but this one is a false cluster discovery. The weighted FDR, the size weighted FDR at the cluster level is 20%. And the reason for that being that if you control for a size weighted cluster level, then you always control also for the FDR on the voxel level if the clusters are completely homogeneous. That is, if they either all the voxels within the clusters contain signal or they don't contain signal. Now here we have the exact same setting, only the statistical analysis is different. So what we have here is these five regions, clusters of discovered. And at the cluster level this time we control the FDR at the 20% level. So it's one out of five. This is a false discovery and we have four true discoveries. However, at the voxel level, it's more than that. It's 30%. But that is because some of the clusters contain also voxels that are really not active. And now and we also have the size-weighted cluster level, and this is 14%. It's even less than the cluster level, the FDR on the clusters. And the reason for that is that if, on average, the clusters of where there's no activity are smaller than those where there is activity, then controlling the FDR at the cluster level will also control the size-weighted FDR at the cluster level. Okay, so what we basically see from this toy example is that controlling the FDR at the voxel level does not guarantee control of the FDR at the cluster level, and vice versa. And therefore, since we want control of the FDR at the cluster level, then this is probably the R measure that should be used. Now, going to real data with poor graphics. We have here two slices, two consecutive slices, and this is the result of a vision experiment. So if we do a cluster level analysis with an FDR level of 10%, we discover 13 clusters, and within them there are 163 voxels. And we see here each different cluster is in a different color. They are contiguous clusters, only they are contiguous in three-dimensional space, so that's why they may seem non-contiguous. So this light blue, this light blue is one cluster, for example. Now if we compare it to a single voxel analysis, then we only discover 55 voxels, and they are grouped into 14 contiguous regions. And this is suggesting that testing clusters is also more powerful, and by simulations, we actually saw it consistently that by testing clusters for activity, we discover more true activations, a larger proportion of true activation. But when we test clusters, then we can only say that there is activity somewhere within this the cluster, and we may want to also know where the activity lies within the cluster. So we can go hierarchically, first test clusters for activity, but then look inside and see where this activity really is. So we call that the cluster testing and trimming procedure. At the cluster testing stage, we apply an FDR controlling procedure, a size-weighted FDR controlling procedure on the clusters. And then at the voxel trimming stage, within the rejected clusters only, we apply an FDR controlling procedure on the conditional p-values, where conditional is on the fact that these voxels are within rejected clusters. And then we keep all the voxel discoveries in the cluster and we trim the others. So what we see here is, for those two slices that I showed before, the conditional p-values. And for example, the light blue cluster that we had here, so it was here and here. If we look here, then the conditional p-values are fairly small, except for except at the edges. So there is one here that was attached and another one here that was attached that looks like it's a non-active voxel. But still, it gives you where it shows that for this light blue cluster, except possibly at the edges, most of the voxels are active. And when we do the the false discovery rate on at the cluster level at the 10%, like we did before, and then for voxel at the level of 25%, because we allow for more false positives, since the issue of control for false positive is more important at the cluster level, then we discover 91 voxels in 13 in all of those clusters that we've detected. And if we do it at the second stage at the 10% level, then we discover only 36 voxels because the condition p-values are quite conservative. So for these images, this image is the conditional p-values. So for this the analysis here, the cutoff is 0.18. Basically, everything that's until this blue color will be discovered. Okay, so to summarize, how to best find the activated brain regions? Well, the first thing to note is that we care about clusters, not voxels. Testing clusters can be much more powerful than testing voxels. We can weight cluster by importance and apply a weighted FDR controlling procedure. And then we conclude that one or more of the voxels within a rejected cluster contains signal. With the cluster testing and trimming procedure, we can conclude about voxels as well. And we can choose the level of testing at the second stage to be larger than, say, the 5% or 10% typically used, since the precision necessary is that of a general region, not the exact spatial voxels. And finally, also with the cluster testing and treatment procedure, we can focus attention to discovered clusters where a large proportion of voxels are discovered. So if really the noise correlation is smaller than that of cluster size, then if we find out a lot of voxels active within the cluster, then we have even more confidence that this is a really interesting cluster, that there is a lot of activity in it going on. Okay, so this was the first part. Now I'm going to go on to the second part of finding brain regions that respond to several cognitive tests. And for this part, I'm going to reduce to clusters of size 1, which means basically to the voxel level. But this is just because it's a separate work. Really, the way that it should be done is to define the clusters first and then test the clusters for the method that I'm going to introduce. So basically, instead of voxels, the entire methodology carries over also for testing clusters. This is just not the way it was done in the examples that I'm going to present here. Okay, so from now on, I'm going to talk about locations, but really, the same thing carries over when I talk about clusters. Okay, so here we have an fMRI vision experiment, and the brain activity is measured. What we have is four visual stimuli: faces, houses, common man-made objects, and geometric patterns. These four visual stimuli are introduced to the subject in the magnet, and the researcher is interested in finding the regions that were more active during the first three stimuli than the fourth one. So what we have here is a red location and a blue location over time. So this is the time axis and this is the signal intensity. And we see that at different time points, different images are introduced. And we see that both for the red location and for the blue location, the activity is higher when viewing images than when images are not shown. However, for the red location, the activity when showing identifiable objects is also higher than when showing geometric patterns. So this is higher than here, here it's again higher than here, here, and this also is higher. And these red locations are the locations that the researcher is interested in. So in order to answer that, typical analysis tests in each location whether the average activation during the first three stimuli is higher than during the fourth one, adjusting for the multiple comparison problem using the BH procedure, which is the original FDR controlling procedure that was introduced by Benjamin and Hochberg, let's say at the 5% level. So we have here again the flattened image showing in color the detected locations, and we know that 5% of this, we expect 5% of this area to be false. The problem with this analysis is that it does not tell us whether the discovered regions are due to all or only some of the contrasts. So we have three contrasts: faces versus pattern, houses versus pattern, and man-made objects versus pattern. And what we want is really to find the regions that identify objects from textured patterns. In order to be able to do that, the researcher is really interested in the areas where the contrast is positive for all three contrasts. But what is discovering here is whether it's active in at least one of the contrasts. It can be, for example, that there is a face-sensitive area, and then that all the discoveries are actually due to sensitivity to faces, not due to the fact that the region identify objects from patterns. So in order to be able to answer, to find that out, perhaps a naive approach would be for each contrast to do a separate analysis. So we have faces versus patterns, and we can do an analysis of that with a BH procedure at the 5% level, so we expect only 5% of discoveries to be around here. Then for houses versus patterns, we have the results of the analysis here, and for objects versus pattern, we have the resulting analysis here, and then we may want to take just the superimposed map of the voxels that were found to be active in all these three analyses. The problem is that this does not control any false positive measure. Specifically, the FDR is not necessarily controlled at the 5% level. If the intersection map may contain zero locations that are more active during all of the first three stimuli than the fourth one. So in fact, the FDR is as high as one. This is one possibility. And if you're interested instead at the union map, rather than the intersection map, then you may expect actually up to 15% of false positives, not the 5% false positives that you had in each of the separate analyses. So combining resulting of statistical analysis is not the right way to go about it. So how do we want to control for FDR in combination of maps? Well, the approach should be to combine the test statistics in each voxel instead of the discoveries in each voxel. So in each voxel, the combination of test statistics produces a p-value, and this p-value is different depending on what you want to find out. If you want to find out that at least one contrast is positive, it's a different test than if all contrasts are positive, or possibly if most contrasts are positive. Once you have a p-value map, though, then you can apply the BH procedure on these p-values to control the false discovery rate. So I'm going to first concentrate now on one voxel. What is the appropriate test for one voxel? And afterwards, I'm going to go about the procedure for screening the many voxels that we typically have. So for one voxel, we have n null hypotheses that we want to test. In our example, we have three contrasts. So we have the null hypothesis that the contrast of faces versus patterns is zero, and same for houses versus patterns and man-made objects versus patterns. And what the typical analysis that I show you does is testing the global null that all of these hypotheses are true. So basically, in our example, the null that all contrasts are zero. And the problem with this null is that it is often too general to be scientifically meaningful. So what I'm going to find out from testing such a null, if I reject it, is that at least one of the contrasts is positive, but now I don't know, is it because it identifies an object from patterns, or is it just because there is sensitivity to faces? So what the researcher really wants to test is the second null here, that at most n minus one of the null hypotheses are false. So in the example, this is the null that at most two contrasts are positive. If I reject this null, then I can say, well, all three contrasts are positive, and this is exactly what the researcher wants to find out. The problem is that this is difficult to reject in practice when screening a large number of such nulls. Therefore, we offer an in-between approach, and this is to test the partial conjunction hypothesis that at most U minus one of the null hypotheses are false. So in our example, it is the null that at most one contrast is positive. The alternative is that at least two out of the three contrasts are positive, or that most contrasts are positive. The partial conjunction hypothesis has been suggested in another setting of by Friston et al. And there they treated only the independent case. What we're going to do is show a more powerful procedure for the independent setting, as well as the situation, how to deal with dependencies such as what we have here. So basically, this partial conjunction hypothesis with u equals to 2 in our example is more informative than the first one, and it is more powerful than the second one. So this may be, in our example, the more appropriate procedure testing hypothesis to use. So now I'm going to show how to test for such a partial conjunction hypothesis by first showing what was available before. And this is for the following setting. So for u equals to n, it's the maximum p-value and that should be tested. So basically, we test whether the maximum out of the three contrast p-values is less than or equal to alpha. So you see here also, by the way it's tested, why it is conservative, and in the face of multiplicity, it will be really hard to reject. Right? If you have 10,000 and we always take the maximum, we will detect very little. Now, for testing the global null, there are many different tests, and which test to use depends also on the relationship between the p-values. So if the p-values are independent, then a common method is to use the Fisher combining method. And there are many other ones as well. Now, for positive dependent p-values, such as the case that we have, because we have each of the first three stimuli are compared to the same control stimulus. So for that type of dependency, positive dependency, we can use what we call the Symes test. And this is this one. I won't go into the details. For general dependency between the p-values, we can always revert to Bonferroni. So Bonferroni just says, well, if the minimum p-value is less than or equal to alpha over n, then we reject the global null. Or alternatively, we can look at it as the adjusted p-value is n times the minimum p-value, and if this is less than or equal to alpha, then we reject the global null. Now, for testing partial conjunctions, we're going to base our test on the test of the global null, and the idea is to look only at the n minus u plus 1 largest p-values and combine them as if they were testing a global null. So just as an example, if we have independent p-values, then we can use the Fisher method. And let's say that we have three p-values. This is only for one location. So we have three values for that location. One contrast, the p-value is 0.5. Another contrast is 0.02. And the third one is 0.01. So for testing the global null, when we combine using Fisher, we are actually getting a p-value of 0.005, which is much smaller than any of these. And the reason is because we pulled information from all three p-values, and then there is something going on within this voxel. So we have quite strong evidence that at least one of the contrasts are positive. If we want to say more, though, that at least two out of the three contrasts are positive, then we have to combine. We cannot combine the first, the smallest p-value, but we're going to combine only these two, and then we're going to get a p-value of 0.056. So it's larger than for the global null, but we can also say more. We can say that it's not at least one contrast that is positive, but if the cutoff value is larger than 0.056, then we can say that most of the contrasts are positive. And if we want to be able to say that all contrasts are positive, then we have to test it with the maximum of these three, which is 0.5. So clearly, we cannot do that in this example. And using this combining function for the p-values gives us a valid p-value for testing the partial conjunction on, which is a valid p-value in the sense that if we want a size alpha test, then this will indeed guarantee that the size of the test is alpha. And for positive dependency, it's the same thing. We just combine the n minus 2 plus 1 largest p-values, but we combine them using the signs method for testing the global null. For Bonferroni, it's very simple to what this combining function is. So for Bonferroni, we take the n minus 2 plus 1 largest p-values, and then we look at the smallest of these. So the smallest of the n minus 2 plus 1 largest p-values is basically the u's largest p-value. So we have n minus 2 plus 1 times the largest p-value. This is the partial conjunction p-value. And this is, again, a valid p-value for the partial conjunction hypothesis. Okay, so this was just a test for one location. Now we have 100,000 locations. So the way to go about it is to specify the partial conjunction hypothesis. I call it the screening hypothesis, because really we have n hypotheses that are associated with a location, and then we combine them into one hypothesis of evidence of whether this location is interesting to look at. For this partial conjunction hypothesis, we compute the partial conjunction p-values, and then we apply the Benjamini-Hopfer procedure at level q on these partial conjunction p-values. Okay, and it doesn't even have to be the same partial conjunction hypothesis for every location. You just have to specify it in advance, but it can be different one for different locations. And this procedure controls the FDR. We showed it theoretically in under various settings, as well as in simulations, that it really guarantees controls of the false discovery rate for the type of dependency that is in fMRI. Okay, so we do this procedure, and then we expect only 5% of our discoveries to have really a true null partial conjunction hypothesis. Let's see it in our example. So we had 4 stimuli, we had 3 contrasts, and we want to find the regions that were more active during the first read and the fourth one. For partial conjunction hypothesis, we pull the p-values using signs because we have positive dependency, and then we apply the BH procedure at the 5% level. What we see here is, again, the flattened image of the brain, and when we do the procedure with u equals to 3, then we find these are the locations that we found that we can say that all contrasts are positive in them, and again, we expect 5% of this region basically to be false. If we do it at u equals to 2, then our discoveries are the yellow and the blue regions. And if we do it with u equals to 1, then our discoveries are the red, yellow, or blue regions. And not a much wider activation of the red regions, and the reason for that is that this really finds contrast-specific areas, such as face areas. But if you want to find the regions that identify objects from null, then you should really look at the yellow and blue regions, which is basically the analysis with u equals to 2. And this really identified also the regions that the most robust functional signature for the regions is the distinguishing of objects from textured patterns. However, note that what we did here was really imposed three types of analysis. We did one analysis with u equals to 1, one analysis with u equals to 2, and another analysis with u equals to 3. So we did a whole lot more tests, and the question is, well, aren't we inflating our error possibly, because we're really imposing three different analyses just on one display. And it turns out that what we're controlling now when we do this is not the false discovery rate, but what we are controlling is the following. What we're controlling is that only 5%, we expect only 5% of the U's that we show to be higher than the true number of positive contrasts. So So basically what we have here is the lower bound on the number of contrasts, and we expect only 5% of those lower bounds to be false. And this is a very irrelevant error measure to control. And this is called the overall FDR, or OFDR for short. To define it properly, we need some terminology. So a discovered voxel is a voxel for which at least one null hypothesis has been rejected. In our example, it is the global null, when we tested it with u equals to 1. A falsely discovered voxel is a voxel for which at least one null hypothesis has been incorrectly rejected. So in our example, it's either that we have rejected it with u equals to 1, where actually none of the contrasts are active, or if we rejected it with u equals to 2, where less than 2 of the contrasts are active, or with u equals to 3, where less than 3 of the contrasts are active. And the overall FDR is the expected proportion of falsely discovered voxels out of all the discovered voxels. So in our example, it's the expected proportion of discovered voxels where the largest u rejected exceeds the true number of positive contrasts. And an overall FDR controlling procedure really doesn't have to do a separate analysis with a BH procedure for every single u, but can be more powerful than that. And it's if you're interested in advance only in controlling the overall FDR, then what you can do is for each voxel compute the global null p-value and then apply the BH procedure on these global null p-values. Now let's say that our voxels have rejected the global null hypothesis. Then we test sequentially within these R voxels the partial conjunction hypothesis for u equals to 2, u equals to 3, etc. At level RQ over S, where R is the number of voxels with rejected global null hypothesis, Q is FDR level for the initial screening, and S is the total number of voxels that are tested. So there's a typo here. What we find, what we declare is the maximum U for which the partial conjunction p-value has been less than or equal to RQ over S. So the last one until the first set is no longer rejected. So if for U equals to 3, the partial conjunction is bigger than RQ over S, then what we are going to say is that this voxel has a lower bound of 2. So for if we do it with a Q level of Q of 5%, then we expect only 5% of these max U's to exceed the true number of positive contrasts. This is what it means to control the overall FDR. And just to see, this is again the analysis, the resulting analysis that I've shown you before, and this is the typical analysis that I showed you at the beginning. So the typical analysis tests only the global null, which is really testing u equals to 1, only with a different test statistic than the one that we have used. That's why we don't get the same amounts. But notice how much more information you actually get by doing the overall FDR controlling procedures. Because here you cannot really say, well, is it due to one contrast or is it due to all contrasts or to most contrasts? Whereas here it clearly separates it, so it's much more useful, have more information. Okay. And now we're replacing contrast by subject, we can do a group analysis. So I'll just recap first on what typically is done in group analysis and then show our suggestion. So for group analysis, there is either fixed effects analysis, which I guess nobody is using probably, but this is equivalent to screening whether at least one of the subjects activates a location. So it's really testing partial conjunction with u equals to 1 or the global null. It is very weak scientific finding because it can be all the results can be driven just by one outlying subject. Another typical analysis is a random effect analysis that tests whether the population average task effect is positive under two assumptions. One, that the group is a random sample from the population, which is typically not it, but that's not the big problem. But the other assumption is that the true subject task effects come from a normal distribution. And this assumption is typically violated, because even after registration, still it's not voxel on top of activating voxels from the different brains, because they're so different from each other. After normalizations, you still don't have the right overlap. And therefore, even when you do a random effect analysis, if you interpret the result as if this is an area where there is a population average task effect, it may not be so, and it still can be driven entirely by just one subject. So instead, what we're suggesting, or in addition, I guess, is to do an overall FDR controlling procedure on the subject. So this will generalize the fixed effect analysis, because it will not do only U equals to 1, but also U equals to 2, 3, etc. And it is valid even when the random effect analysis assumptions are violated. So let's see it here. So this is one contrast of the faces versus houses. So showing images of faces versus showing that of houses. Here it is an unsmooth data. The random effect analysis shows no significant voxels. Well, if we do it with partial conjunctions, then we find quite a lot. If we do it with smoothing the image first, then the random effect analysis has this map of discoveries. Now, if we compare it to that of the overall FDR controlling procedure, then we see that in dark red, the regions where we can only say that at least one of the subjects activates the voxel, and in light yellow, where at least 8 of the subjects activate a voxel. So, and we could not find anything for at least 9 or at least 10. We had overall 19 subjects. So it's a little bit disappointing that we can say anything. The lower bounds are even less than half the subjects, but this again is due to the large variability between the brains even after normalization. What it does tell us here that there are areas where there is a bigger consistency between the subjects. These are the light yellow areas here, whereas with a random effect analysis you really don't know. So for example, this area here, it looks like it's entirely driven by one or perhaps two subjects. This one is really, it looks like it's entirely by one. But this one also, and this one has been detected in the random effect analysis. So if you do a random effect analysis, then I think that also doing an overall FDR controlling procedure for partial conjunctions can be very useful in order to interpret your findings. And in addition, what you can do is both partial conjunction on subjects and partial conjunction on contrast. And this is again what this is showing here. Here it's actually testing the global null, I think. And this is a random effect analysis for the 19 subjects that we have, where here it is our method of using partial conjunctions. So here again, we see the areas where there's bigger consistency between the subjects. And then this area here, it looks like it's driven entirely by one subject, but in the random effect analysis, it is showing up. So to summarize, well, the overall FDR is an appropriate error measure for a superimposed display. If you really have a lot of analysis that you attempted to do, then do that instead if you want to superimpose your results. For finding the regions that react to more than one contrast, then you first test the global null in each voxel, and then sequentially test for partial conjunction hypothesis. And for group analysis, you repeat that, only replacing contrast by subject, and then you get a lower bound on the proportion of subjects that activate each voxel. And by controlling the FDR again, the overall FDR, you expect only 5% to control it at a level of Q equals 5%. You expect only 5% of your discoveries to be false ones. Another possible application, there's been talk here on reproducibility and the importance of reproducibility of fMRI studies is to do the same thing but replacing contrast by study. And then you do a meta-analysis of fMRI studies and you get a lower bound on the proportion of studies that discover each voxel. And this can be also a very useful thing to do. Now to connect back to my first part, the first part of my talk, so we benefit from first clustering contiguous voxels and then combining the cluster p-values rather than the individual p-values per subject in order to do, let's say, partial conjunction analysis or group analysis. Now the question is how to find the common clusters for the group analysis. If we want, in order to test the partial conjunctions on an individual subject, it's not a problem. We find clusters and we test those clusters using the partial conjunction test with the cluster p-values instead of the voxel p-values. But now, if we have different subjects and we want to do group analysis, different clusters will be for different subjects, and the question is how to be able to define common clusters in order to do group analysis for testing. Okay, that's it. There is software available for both the methods in my website right here, and this is a list of the references that I've mentioned specifically for the partial conjunction. There has been a paper in NeuroImage, Conjunction Group Analysis and Alternative to Mixed and Random Effect Analysis in NeuroImage. And there has been another one, it's right here, on the cluster stuff. Okay. It depends on what the signal configuration is, the true signal configuration.
Right, but imagine then that what I did was not to control each one of the maps at 0.05, but at 0.01.
Yeah, that's fine. Then it will control, but you are doing a more conservative procedure, and there's no need to do that. You don't have to pay for the fact that you are doing different things. You can actually gain from combining first the p-values, because then you may have even more power. So you can do it this way, but there's a better way.
I have two questions, actually. First more to confirm, the clusters, they are defined by using a global threshold?
Or no.
Or correlation with the neighbors?
Yes, correlation with the, so every this is on outside data, though. On the localizing experiment, every voxel chooses the voxel that's of one of its 26 neighbors that it is maximally correlated with it, and then this one also chooses one, and they walk about, and it turns out to be very small, fairly small clusters that are actually.
Right. And then how should we report when we analyze data using this? How should we report that in a paper? What would be the best way to tell people that use this technique and the significance, the meaning of it, the significance of it?
Well, this is just you have cluster discoveries. And you expect 5% of those cluster discoveries to be false. Now, it's true that these are random clusters because they've been done from a localizing experiment. You'll do it again, and you'll have a different localizer experiment and different clusters. But still, the overall image of discoveries will not change that much. And what you know is that 5% of the cluster discoveries of your units of testing are basically are those where the null hypothesis is true. But so it's a small percentage, so you trust your result.
How would you be able to use a technique like this in a case where you don't have an adequate functional localizer, where you can have a separate scan identified?
Well, one option is to just take part of your data, of your experiment, in order to sacrifice it, basically, in order to define clusters, and it may be worth it. We really, from the simulations that we did, it seemed like a much more powerful procedure than testing single voxels. Yes.
Two points. One is I'm not sure to what extent your method could be adjusted to take account of a different approximation from the Fisher method, because that is there are some strange behaviors of that, and it's perhaps not an optimal way of combining
values. As long as the function is monotone, as long as it's a valid test of the global null, and then you're combining the n minus u plus 1 largest p values using whichever method for testing the global null, then you get a valid p value for testing the partial conjunction null.
Okay, because I think Fisher's method has some paradoxical effects, like, for instance, you can have an increasing number of not very near threshold effects, like 0.4, but you have a large number of them. So there's some seems to be collective evidence for the null hypothesis not being correct.
Well, this is just a factor of that means that the global null may not be correct. Also, I mean, if what Fisher is testing the global null, I mean, in that sense, it will have it will be distributed uniformly if it the global null is true, but otherwise.
The other is, do you have anything to contribute to the issue of lack of independence of the test, in particular when you are comparing the three conditions against the pattern control?
Right. So that's why the combining function uses the times test that has a positive, that is valid for positive dependent data. Okay, so if you have all treatments compared to the same control treatment, which is our case, of all three stimuli compared to the same control stimulus, you have positive dependency. And that's why we use the time test. Now, this is positive dependency within the p-values within the voxel, not across the voxel. So you have two types of dependencies. There's a positive dependency across the voxels that the BH procedure takes care of, and there's the positive dependency within the voxel, and for that you have to be careful on which combining method you're actually using. And if you are not willing to assume that it's positive dependent, then you have to resort to Bonferroni, let's say.
Does that require symmetric positive dependency? The signed procedure.
The technical term is PRDS, positive regression dependency on the subset of null hypothesis. I can show it to you.
I thought that was very interesting, the way you moved to a group analysis. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be used in the community and what should be done to be used in the community, but I thought that was a very nice extension and a very interesting, almost going to reproducibility results.
Right, exactly. It does give some more confidence, and instead of looking at every segment, but this is what Rafael Malach said, that actually he does not trust whatever methods that there are, then he just has a gallery of pictures, basically for every subject, just a gallery. And then here instead you have it on a superimposed display. It's much more convenient.
It is very interesting.
Yeah.
If there's no more questions, then I'd like to thank all the speakers and thank you for your attention. And it was a good day. Thank you.